I've been doing 3 or 4 interviews a day.
Oh, yeah.
First, I'd like to ask you if you consider yourself a politically active person now.
Politically active? No, never was. Semi-political, that's all. I've never been interested in politics, except that it has affected the labor movement primarily, and then, of course, in general citizenship. But no, I am not.
By general citizenship, you mean voting?
Yeah, regular voting, and that's all. I'm interested in candidacy issues, but not to become political, in a sense, never.
In terms of being a candidate yourself?
No.
Were you ever approached to
many times. Always turned it down. Sure.
I remember you telling me that you had been approached to be Secretary of Labor.
Twice, yeah. Turned it down.
At the time of the strike, did you consider yourself politically active?
For the general strike? No. I just returned from the First World War and hadn't really got back into the swing of civilian activity at that time.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel there's been a political leader in recent years who's spoken to you?
Has spoken for me?
Do you feel sort of speaks the type of things that you want spoken in the political world?
Well, yeah, I think very definitely Roosevelt did. Though I think he made a very bad mistake in running after his second term, and definitely after the third one.
Why was that?
Well, because I think that he had gained the greatest momentum for the things he advocated, and then much of it became political, and in the process of his political action, I think he was deterred from the great accomplishment he could have made by stepping out.
Has there been anyone since then that you felt a politician really had your confidence?
Well, yes. Yeah, I certainly had confidence in Truman, very definitely. And to a degree in John Kennedy, not his associates, some of them, but for him, yes. In the early days of his administration, I think he did very well. But I never had the confidence in the inside procedure of his office as I did with Roosevelt or Truman. I think the Bay of Pigs and that sort of thing was a terrible blunder. The CIA under the observation of leadership of, not leadership really, but observation and use of Bobby Kennedy was one of the things that the longer you investigate it, the worse it'll be in the minds of the American public. Eisenhower was a good friend of mine. I endorsed some of the things he did, but I don't think he was in any sense a student of economics to the degree to benefit labor.
And how about recently? Has there been any political figures real recently?
No. I took no active part in the administration of Johnson or Ford. Feel friendly towards Ford, but I took no activity.
How about Jimmy Carter? Are you waiting?
No, I've never had no contact with Carter. I'm in harmony with much he advocates. It's just a matter of whether time will prove that some of the things he advocates are feasible, practical, or politically possible. I don't think much. I've been so terribly busy. I haven't had no time for political activity.
What do you think is the most important issue facing the country today?
Oh, I think very definitely economic. I think there's a tremendous unemployment situation, of course, is number one above everything else. And then, of course, inflation, one revolves around the other. I think there has to be some absolute control over interest. High interest rates, in my opinion, is destructive to our progress, and I think it's going to advocate a procedure of changing a great part of the American standard of living such as home construction and that sort of thing. So that's the outstanding by far in my opinion. Unemployment, economics, and inflation.
Just for my own curiosity, what would you do if you were president today? What would you do about this issue?
Well, I would have, 4 or 5 years ago when I advocated, I would have froze prices, wages, interest, and everything, and started from a base there to control it. But that was not done. And in my opinion, it has created a situation now that nobody knows exactly where it's going to end.
What do you like most about this country?
Everything. Everything.
Well, that's going to make my next question a little hard to answer. I was going to ask you what you like least about this country.
There's nothing that I don't like about this country when I compare it with any other country in the world, and that's the only way you can do. There are things, of course, that I would change if it were within my power to do it, but I've advocated those changes associated with labor for the last 60 years. But on the whole, I think this is by far the greatest country in the world in every phase of its social and economic business life. And so to compare it, there is no comparison as far as I'm concerned. We can improve our performance, our government, our administrative departments of government, but I don't think we can improve upon the constitutional structure of it.
Is there anything in the news lately that made you feel especially good?
Lately? No, I don't think so. I think we're starting to pull out of the unemployment situation, unless we get further into inflation or high interest rates and et cetera, I think it'll be good news. It'll be a long pull yet.
Is there anything in the news lately that's made you especially mad?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think we're involved in political action in parts of the world that have got to be handled very carefully. Are they going to affect our own business and economic life?
Are there some of you specifically?
Well, Africa for one, the Far East, the Russian situation, the Cuban situation, all of them are tied into it.
What great people, living or dead, do you admire most?
Well, there's so many of them, I couldn't count them. I couldn't, can't think of them here at random. But in every phase of our social and economic life, there's been great figures that you cannot help but admire. Some even that you disagree with on one thing, you greatly admire them in another. Marshall, for instance, in the conduct of the war, Roosevelt very definitely, Truman, I could name them for the next half hour, many, many, many of them.
I won't take up that much of your time. I'd like to ask you some things, as I told you before, that are mostly attitudes towards human nature or something. Would you say that most people can be trusted or that you can't be too careful?
Well, it's in what sense you use that. If their word is good, or what do you mean by it?
Well, you feel that what your basic stance towards people is that you can trust them. Before you know someone, you believe that you can trust that person, or that you should adopt the stance.
No, I don't think you can trust people until you have an acquaintanceship with them and do business with them to the point where you can judge that by actual experience. Though I think a great vast army of humanity can be trusted with reasonable degree of success.
Then do you think that most of the time people try to be helpful, that they're looking out for themselves?
I think the human equation is there, and in most instances they're looking out for themselves.
So would most people try to take advantage of you if they got the choice, or would they try to be fair?
It's according to what you're dealing with. Many phases of business, they would take advantage of you, and in other areas, and still are some people of tremendous high principle that would not.
Could you, would would it be hard to put some sort of amounts on it? How, what percentage of people you think are one type and what percentage are the other?
No, I couldn't do it.
Do you think what most young people need most of all is strict discipline by their parents?
Yes, I think discipline is a very, very, very necessary factor. Definitely. Particularly in the children, raising children.
Do you think that most people who don't get ahead don't because they don't have enough willpower?
Well, no, I don't think that. I think the average American has a reasonable amount of education and good home discipline and etc. has the start to make good in the economic life of the world. At the same time, I think there's a tremendous number of them that's been deprived of it. And I don't think education or anything else is an actual factor.
Do you think that willpower is a large factor in it?
Oh, you mean self willpower? Definitely. Because willpower develops character. That's the number one essential in my opinion.
Do you think a few strong leaders would do more for the country than all the laws and talks?
No, I think we've got to have laws. And I think those leaders find their place in carrying out law and paving the way for the initiation of laws that are needed to meet conditions that they arrive. That is in the legislative and executive field.
The saying, an insult to your honor should not be forgotten. Do you agree with that?
That's a good idea to define it. I don't think you should ever forget it, no. You may forgive it, but I don't forget it.
Good distinction. How do you feel about the school desegregation issue in Seattle now, as we talked about?
Well, I think that definitely we're making progress in every phase of segregation, say the avenues of segregation. But I think that it's just a natural situation for those that are growing up under the favorable conditions, more favorable conditions of segregation, that they're seeking a faster solution to it than perhaps the general social structure will assimilate in some parts of the country. In Seattle, I think, has made great progress.
Do you think there's a lot of talk right now about how to handle the possible ACLU suit against the school board and that whole issue? How do you feel about the busing issue?
I don't believe in compulsory busing, but I do believe that the whole structure upon which our school system was erected, it was neighborhood school. And then the Negro, the black man, was shut out from having equal opportunity due to his economic life and other factors to live in the neighborhoods where the schools were built. So by virtue of that, you created the problem that confronts us now. Now, I think with the passage of time and the acceptance of the broad field of acceptance of integration, we will be able to establish again the living of the blacks alongside of the whites and an interrelationship in the districts and areas, neighborhoods, and we'll go a long way by virtue of it to solve the problem. But it'll take time. Money factors in there. Lots of people that believe 100% in racial acceptance of all kinds. They got money invested in property, and they're actuated in some of their thinking by the fact that black people moving alongside them may deteriorate their property values, and those things that should not be considered are there. The human equation is to give it much thought.
Is that a phrase that started with you, the human equation?
Yes, because I think you're continually confronted with it. You live it every day. Practically everyone you contact is involved.
I've noticed that when you're when I see you thinking about answers, that it's something that you always, so you have to
figure into it. You must consider.
How necessary are employers for running businesses? Could workers run businesses without employers?
No, not then, no. I think, I believe in a capital system. And I do not believe in either socialism or communism. And under our capital system, it requires employers to handle that portion of our administrative affairs. Now, I don't mean by that that competent, qualified labor people, either now or in the future, as they develop ability, that they can't go from one division of operation to another. I think top-notch personnel working in companies over a period of time will develop as individuals to where they can assume executive duties. And that's all it is.
How about these cooperative industries where workers own the industry themselves within capitalist systems, where they own the industry themselves and they just split up the profits between them? Can they be, can they work? Can they be
successful? I think some of them can work. I think some of them can work, but on the whole, I don't think there's a receptive mind to it for the great vast majority of the people in our country. I think in some countries closer to socialism, like Sweden and etc., that they fit in, but not under our system, I don't think they do. I think they can be a factor at times in the temporary sense to compel capital to conduct itself with more thinking towards the great mass of the people.
I remember this sort of side note, but I was over talking with Bill Griffin last week, and he was telling me his father, I think, ran the union have
they
a
ran the mutual laundry.
Was that a cooperative? How did that work?
No, the mutual laundry was conceived in the process of organizing the inside laundry workers and drivers in Seattle against the combine of the great laundry industry. Then it was one of the outstanding industries. And they couldn't break through the maze of opposition developed by the employers, and they started a laundry, called it the Mutual, went out and got public subscription in order to be a competitor in the laundry field. And that has its start, and later it continued on in competition with the others in the laundry industry for many years after the laundry industry was thoroughly organized.
So it was begun for organizing. The reason that it was originally established
was conceived as an avenue of organizing, yes.
And did it then work cooperatively? What happened to the profits in that industry?
Profits all went back into the business, the same as they do any others. And when it became a competitive factor and all the laundries alongside of it were all organized, it slowly deteriorated. Wound up going out of business.
Finally, I'd like to ask you if you've read anything about the general strike since it happened.
Over the years since 19? Oh, yes.
Do you remember what some of those things have been?
Not specifically. I remember, on the whole, I was not in accord at all with the great mass of public information conveyed as it related to the strike, because I think it was not coming from a thorough knowledge of the actual construction of the whole thing.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that? What was the errors that they were making? Well, you say you weren't in accord.
Well, you were asking me the question if I've read about what they wrote about the strike.
Were you saying that you weren't in accord with the strike or with how people wrote about
it? No, I was not in accord with the strike.
Yeah.
I pointed that out. And I think there's very erroneous statements were printed following the strike, and they continue so because they build on themselves. And much of that stuff becomes a news headline. And then that becomes a factor that gets public attention. But basically, the fundamental structure of it was a very simple one. It was an avenue, in my opinion, of direct action, attempting to utilize machinery to accomplish a general strike for the benefit of the Boilermakers and so forth were on strike. That was tremendously out of all possibility their being able to control, was not in harmony with the solution that could be built to function, and therefore it failed.
What is the that wrong impression that Peel's been given from literature that's been written on it?
That the area here of the labor movement was a tremendously a radical area. It was not. It was a progressive area. I mean the mass of the labor movement. That's why the general strike couldn't be a success, because the great majority of labor wasn't going to subscribe to the picture that they were erecting of how to solve that strike problem. But that didn't stop labor. Labor never deteriorated in its accomplishment by reason of the general strike. It created an accomplishment that the time has proven it to have by the solidarity of its soundness in the structure of labor that the great mass of workers supported.
Then, for instance, I don't know, one of the things you're referring to is that I've read that it was actually not the leaders of the unions who wanted the general strike, but the rank and file. You feel that's not true?
Not true at all.
Then it was the leaders who carried it.
Absolutely.
Would you say that's like Jimmy Duncan, Anna Louise Strong, people like that?
I think Jimmy Duncan was associated with it and supported it. But he was not in any sense an advocate of the philosophy it represented, in the sense that Anna Louise Strong or some of those others.
That's all the questions I have on the general strike, but if you can spare a few more minutes.
Go ahead.
Last night I was talking on the phone with a friend of mine in Santa Barbara, and I told him I was coming to interview you, and he studies sociology of labor, and he's been thinking and writing a lot about the change in relationship between labor and government, specifically the change between labor and police, but
labor
also
and
police, the use of police force over the years. And he asked me if I would ask you if you had anything to say about how, in your career, government changed in its relation with labor, and how, in your career, you know, you found difference in politics.
Well, of course, the progress of labor is the best answer to it. Labor has made tremendous progress, and you only have to look around you to see it. You go back 25, 30 years, which is a brief period of time, and the organization of teachers was unheard of. Nurses were unheard of. Police were unheard of. Firemen were unheard of. All phases of public clerical operation, deputy sheriffs, the auditor's office, everything that you can name. For years and years and years and years, there was no organization there. Because in my personal opinion, and some of them, like in the teachers and nurses, and some who had a semi-educated status, maybe they'd gone to college, or they had graduated from high school or eligible to go to college. I think they became an environmental situation where they had a false social position. And they looked down upon the men and women of labor that worked hard and then the grease and the dirt and the everything else. And by virtue of it, the organized structure of that same element, the mechanic and the drivers and all those people, the warehousemen, and et cetera, and et cetera. They started climbing that path of progress and wages, hours, and conditions. And they walked right by this social vision structure in the semi-educated and educated strata, with the result that they woke up all of a sudden that the people that had never gone to college were making far more money than those that did, except where they were engineers or architects or doctors, where you couldn't gravitate to those positions without degrees and so forth. So all of a sudden they wound up that they better get into the organized field and use the collective strength of their position regardless of where they were employed, as teachers or firemen or policemen or anything else, to have an economic strength to structure their wage scales in harmony with the work they were doing. That's that simple.
And how has the power of government changed in relation to labor? I mean, obviously, since the days of Roosevelt, government has been much more favorable towards labor than before. But, for instance, I was just reading in connection with the work I'm doing about the PI strike here. Many people see that as a turning point in the 30s, because the police were not used to break that strike as they had, as in labor's history they ought to have been.
Labor was too strong for the police to break that strike. There was no way in the world they could break that strike, the police. Unless they created a violation of law, then they could do it, perhaps. That meant then the cracking heads and shooting people and that sort of thing, but in the following up the instrumentality of peaceful action and in accordance with law, there was no way they could break this PI strike with police.
So then you don't agree with, some people say that it was because of your close political relationship with Dewar at the time that the police met. It was the collective strength of labor that kept the police
absolutely out
of that situation.
Absolutely. I don't care who was mayor, it wouldn't have made a bit of difference. I think Dewar's position of taking a position, wait a minute here now, the department is not going to allow any violation coming from either labor or capital, from the Hearst organization or anybody else. You're going to be treated equally. I can remember a statement he made over television one night when they made an attack upon him. And he said the Seattle PI on 6th and Union is backing their trucks in half, night after night after night, for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and loading and unloading and stopping the free movement of traffic on 6th Avenue. Now, tomorrow morning, that's going to stop. Unless every merchant in Seattle and 2nd Avenue or anywhere else can use those streets for the same life purpose, the PI is not going to do it. So newspapers were getting tremendous favoritism from business and political life, the same as some instances labor got it. But John Dewar had nothing to do with winning the strike. Now, the strike arose out of the first real test of the guild. It wasn't in the composing room and the mechanical division and the trucking department or the mailing or anything else of the newspaper. It was, the strike revolved around the newspaper reporters and editorial and so forth. Now that's the first strike that they ever had that was national in structure at all. And it was based on that, that the tremendous strength of labor in this particular area that was, had been built to a very high pinnacle of success had the influence to stop the profit structure of the Hearst organization, the PI. That's the story.
Was that, I know that you've been, one of the positions that you're associated with is this insistence that white collar workers also had to be organized. Was that, for you, a very important strike because
yes.
of the organization of white collar
No. I subscribe to the position that we can't all be engineers, or we can't all be doctors, or we can't all be attorneys or architects. Now, in the great mass, the 200 million people that comprise our government, you've got to have millions of people that the only opportunity to earn their living is in fields far removed from just these selected ones where you need a degree and pass a bar examination, etc., to start. So in that great mass, the overwhelming percentage of the personnel employed to earn their daily living and raise their families, you have got to have organizational structure to get them what they can get through bar associations, for instance, or the American Medical Association, or the great organization of the dentists, or the architectural forum, so forth. They have got a specific skill, and they identify themselves in an organization. They don't call it labor, but it forms the same structural procedure. For instance, in the state of Washington, and to the best of my knowledge, at least 95 or 98% of all states in the United States, a lawyer must belong to the Bar Association. Now, the Bar Association is not a public organization in the sense that it's an avenue of our government in the state of Washington or Indiana or anywhere else. Now, you cannot practice law unless you belong to it. And you can't belong to it if you don't pay your dues. Now, that isn't closed shop. I don't understand closed shop. Now, you can go to all of them. As the Dental Association of the United States, for instance, hasn't it for years and years and years thrown out everything they could wisely. They've taken it upon themselves, for instance, to say whether or not, unless a doctor is in good standing in the medical fraternity, that they wouldn't go into a hospital and let them go in there. Now, if that is an economic action, I don't understand economic action. So, in the process of time, just like when you're talking about the general strike or anything else, over the period of years that pass after it occurs, you keep, if you have a developed organization, you keep making definite accomplishments continually, so that what was a tremendous issue back in 1919 don't amount to anything in 1977. Because you have made this progress in every field, and in the process of so doing, you've been so successful in it that you didn't have to go out and organize sheriffs and policemen and all these people that you're talking about. They recognized that they were losing their status of earning for the labor they performed, and the only way they could get a proper sale for it at a right price was to get into a labor organization. And in the evolutionary process, not revolution, evolutionary process, that's where they are now, and they've only started.
So, as I understand your position from this interview and the last one, political action is sort of on the side of, it's not the main avenue for labor that organizing and the
economic action
is. So you said that your own career is based on, the success of your career is based on successful organizing rather than successful political
98% economic action. Now, I wouldn't even say 2% political. Because I told you before, with what government gives you by law, they can take away from you the same way, through Congress or the executive department. And you can struggle and fight and get it that way, and then they can come in and take it away from you overnight. Now, your ability to hold it under those conditions is your economic strength. That's why they can go out here and then overwhelmingly be an anti-labor Congress and a president also. They'll slow you down by virtue of it, because they control the avenues of trade to a degree. But they will not stop you. And sooner or later, you'll be on the rise again. Now, the labor movement has completely changed. Today, you're drifting now into away from the complete craft structure and into the industrial structure of labor. And you're going to find, as you go along, you're going to find an identity of nurses with all of the other phases working in hospitals, for instance. An injury to a nurse in there is going to be considered an injury in the whole working relationship of a hospital for the charwomen and the janitors and everybody else you can think of in hospital. And it's traveling in that direction. Now, I have made the statement, talking before Chambers of Commerce and many others, time after time after time, the greatest organizers the labor movement ever had was the employer, who jammed down their throats by virtue of temporary ability to do it, inhuman conditions and everything else, that drove people into a recognition that their only recourse was to join labor unions, so that there was a competing factor against those kind of people in the industrial field.
This drift to industrial unionism, you feel, is a progressive step, a necessary step?
I think it's a necessary step in our highly mechanized industry that we have today. Because such a tremendous part of all phases of our mechanical life now has drifted away from the individual to machine operation. Carpenters, machinists, everybody that you can name. Production line. You don't assemble a car by hand anymore. You assemble it on the assembly line. And you're rapidly coming to it on mobile homes and anything you can think of. And as I told you before, in my personal opinion, largely the compulsion of that has come from labor. Because they couldn't destroy labor and revert back to the bad conditions that created labor. So then they had to go ahead and take advantage of the highest productivity they could get out of labor. And the way to do that was to mechanize. So they mechanized. And by virtue of mechanization, they got higher percentage of return on their dollar invested in labor salary than they could have ever got as an individual and use an obsolete method. So for years and years and years, our American government was competing around the world with that individual opposition in the march of trade as against our mechanized. And we were, as I told you before, laying coal down on the docks around the world under the highest paid labor in the mining industry of the world at less money than they could compete against it. But now in that process, evolutionary, the same thing is coming in Japan and all over the world. You know, to take Toyota right now and Datsun and these other mechanical products of the automotive field from Japan. They're having a hell of a time now to compete with them on an equal footing unless you erect some sort of a tariff structure to equalize that competitive condition between labor paid in Japan and labor paid in this country. And that's all over the world. So that's the future of the leaders of labor.
Someone, I heard someone talking, saying that the business world is now being structured, that it may be too late even for industrial unions, that because some corporations now deal with several different industries, that for labor to effectively, say, be able to strike a corporation, it has to have connections between any, that you would have to have conglomerate unions the way you have business conglomerates, so that if AT&T owns the phone company, but also Continental Bakeries, that if Continental Bakeries are on strike, you could have some sort of alliance between the Continental Bakery workers and phone company workers. Do you feel that's necessary, or will industrial unions be stronger?
I don't say that in the far distant future sometimes. And that may be a plausible procedure to follow, but certainly it isn't now. Because the momentum that labor has developed now in the present status of ownership, whether it's in joint companies owned and in other fields of their actual, like telephone company, they own, as you say, Langendorf, Bacon, or Continental, or something. That isn't necessary yet. Now, if that becomes necessary in the evolutionary process, or laws are created that throw a bulwark against the progress of labor in some of them, then they'll have to adjust to it, certainly. But again, it's that evolutionary process. And it's under momentum now, far greater than it ever had in its history.
And will that always, that momentum be steadily greater?
If labor properly conducts itself. You've got to develop leadership and executive ability and administrative ability, because in my opinion, you're again coming back to selling labor. You're selling it the same as Langendorf selling bread. You're finding it in the sports field. Look at the evolutionary process that's occurring there in baseball and football and basketball, tennis, all these sports. Because that individual now will be in a union. Unless as an individual without belonging to a union, the employer recognizes the strength that he had if he comes over to a union. So the employer now has been compelled, and in the process of doing it, the Supreme Court of the United States has never yet ruled 100% on the issue of the contract. The reserve clause. Absolutely, all right. In spite of the fact that the United States Supreme Court has not ruled it, a combination and restraint of trade, which it is. In spite of that, the threat that you would perhaps have a labor union taking in baseball players and football players, etc. Now let's say that the Teamsters Union went out here by virtue of the ball players said, we can't fight this great combination of organized baseball as individuals or with our attorneys. We can't get a clear-cut decision on the reserve clause out of the United States Supreme Court. We get up to the appellate court, that's as far as we've been able to get so far. Now we'll come into the Teamsters Union. So they come in here and they join the Teamsters Union. Now the Teamsters have a strike down here for those employees that are playing baseball down at the Dome. You think there's a Chinaman's chance in the world for a ball club to conduct a strike against those ball players and win it? With the control over, not control, but the agitation that would be developed of not to patronize that ball club. How long do you think it would last? But the employer knows that now. In this evolutionary process, he's come to learn it. So he's moved heaven and earth, Rozelle and the others, to get something, any damn thing that's better from their vision of it, than letting them get into a trade union. All right, now out of it, you take, for instance, just visualize it from a business standpoint. There's a young ball player with Detroit, the Bird. All right. He's been in baseball last season. That's his first real bath of Major League Ball. He was signed for $18,000 a year. All right. Now, he won about 5 or 6 or 7 games. He started talking to the baseball and everything else you could think of. He created a favorable atmosphere of public relations for himself as well as the ball club. And all of a sudden he was drawing crowds, no matter where the hell he was pitching, of up around 40, 45, 50,000 people. Now Detroit played here about 4 weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, all right. Seattle played against him and beat him in Detroit. Now, when he came out here for this series, he didn't pitch. He pitched down in Oakland the other night, just before he came into Seattle, because in his routine of every fourth day or every third day of every fourth day, it was his turn to pitch. So he wasn't in turn to pitch in Seattle. All right, the day before he pitched in Oakland, they had 3,500 people in the stand. The day before that, they had around 4,000. And their Sunday crowd was only 6 or 7. When he pitched the other night in Oakland, they had damn near 42,000 people. Now, when somebody starts to argue that he isn't entitled to more than 18,000 when he could draw that many people through the gate, and Vida Blue that they could have sold for $1.5 million, is pitching before 3,500. Somebody that's got some business sense better take a good look at it. Now that's all wound up in the administrative factors of labor. And the employer right now is sitting there knowing that there's people over here that know the labor movement. They know business just as much as any of the business people know it. If they don't know it, then they go over to some of these business people that's got exceptional value of experience and etc., hire them to get their advice. But they're sitting here watching this thing all the time. Now they're not making no move to get the ball players because to start with, compared with truck drivers, they're only a less than 2 fingers instead of a handful even. But the people over here, the attorneys representing the ball players, they're smart on it, they know it. And so they let just enough get out for the ball club to know, well, what the hell do you want? Do you want to deal with us as representing these people outside of organized labor, or are you going to drive them into organized labor? Now, you let the teams just call a strike down here tonight. If they had the Seattle baseball players, what the hell, you might as well send the franchise out, go back and close the doors down there. The loss would be so great that the only way in the world they could possibly survive would be for the rest of the league to bail them out. And how long would that last? No one knows. So those factors are all in there. That's why I continually say the successful people in labor Those that aren't going to get out here on a lot of wild ideas and theory and philosophy, that's all right, study them if they're any good, adopt them. But just keep in mind that you're selling the only damn thing that individual owns to sell, and that's labor. And stay right on it and do an administrative job on it with intelligence and ability to sell it. And you don't need to worry about all the damn chambers of commerce and banks and industrial associations. One by one, they'll, time will solve them too. It's that simple. In my book.
Last question. How do you feel about these attempts that are being made to unionize the Army?
I'm against it.
Will it happen, do you think?
No, I do not think so. I don't think the labor movement itself will support it. There may be some individuals in it that would do it. But I mean labor. I great mass of people that constitutes labor. I don't think they will, no, because I think when we have got to develop an army and a navy and a marine corps and a airplane division and et cetera, there isn't a one of us that isn't hopeful we'll never have to use it. That's the last thing that we ever want, because those of us living now, at least we'll have heirs to our present position here that will be in those wars if they come, no matter how far off they are. So you have got to develop an organization in the war zones of operation, the Army, the Navy, and etc., that's removed from the rest of our social and economic life. And you've got to train people at West Point, Annapolis, and these other places. You train them for the day you hope that'll never come. But if it does come, you've got to be prepared for it. So therefore, in my opinion, it does not identify itself with labor. I think men who consecrate their life to the cause of military action, I believe 100% in military conscription, because I think it's a civic duty of every individual in our country to be eligible, if necessary, to defend this country in war. And we can't set up our own economic self as a decider of what time they go and when they don't go. But when the people to whom we designate the power, and sometimes they'll make mistakes, they have made them without question. In Vietnam and other places, and in getting into some, that's all right, we all make. You can back that human equation again. Sure, they'll make mistakes, but the vast interests of the great mass of our people, 98% of them, has wound up in a tremendous military machine that we hope we'll never have to use. No matter what the hell it costs, whatever we pay for it, it's worth it. I don't mean going out here and spending money in the field of somebody grafting and etc., but whatever the hell it costs, so that we'll never have a day when we will have to go to war, because nobody will want to go to war with us, whatever the hell that cost is, borne by the 2 million that make up this population, it's damn well worth it. And it has no place, in my opinion, in organized labor at all. None.
Great. Democracy, accepting at those times when one or the any group of them are in conflict or dispute with the working people. That's the only time they can come into any sort of an agreement to solidarize. All other times, they are competing, even within their own industry. There is a competition that goes in there with all the waste of competition. And all the waste of competition brings. That is going on. And when they have once full builders function, I can't tell you, don't ask me to give you a calendar dates when it will happen, but within your lifetime, maybe within the lifetimes of your children, remember, that's only a brief moment in history. The change must take place. What it will be, I don't know. Maybe, I hope not, maybe we'll have to go through some sort of process. Maybe before we finally become free men, we'll have to have Big Brother. as is described in 1984. Maybe. Unless the working class becomes class conscious, we can realize what their historic mission is, and that is to do away with capitalism, to become the free society. They have, that they cannot, if they will stand fast, there is no force that can be brought against them that will defeat them, because to defeat them you would have to destroy them, and when you destroy them, you destroy the only creative force that there is, the only ones who are able to create goods for us all to use. And we have the strongest arms, stronger than any that can ever be invented by any munitions firm anywhere on the face of the earth at any time. We have arms much stronger than any they can ever devise. This guy. Just that. Refuse to function on the job. Just as simple as that. Folded arms. Well, Wobblies used to have a song. Some of the words went like this. If the workers take an ocean, they can stop all speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, they can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine, and every mill, fleets and armies of nations will occur. A man stands still. And it's true. All they have to do is all working people all over the world at the same time say no before their lives.